Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, Australia's government apologises for the pain and suffering inflicted in the past on the nation's Aboriginal people. We hear reactions from the president of the Australian Bishops' Conference. And the Church and climate change. One of the Catholic world's leading experts on global warming explains why the Church must be in the front line in this battle to save our planet. Church leaders in Australia have welcomed a move by the government to apologise publicly for past wrongs inflicted on the Indigenous Aboriginal population. Prime Minister Kevin Rudd on Wednesday made the apology in Parliament for past laws and policies which he said inflicted profound grief, suffering and loss on all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, especially the so-called stolen generation of children who were taken from their families to be raised in white households.
We apologise for the laws and policies of successive parliaments and governments that have inflicted profound grief, suffering and loss on these our fellow Australians.
The Prime Minister's words were beamed around the country on television and on giant screens set up outside the Parliament, where crowds of Aboriginal people had gathered to hear his speech. Today, Aboriginal people make up just 2% of the population, and they remain the most disadvantaged group in society, with high rates of infant mortality, alcoholism, drug abuse, unemployment, and a significantly lower life expectancy.
For the pain, suffering, and hurt of these stolen generations, their descendants, and for their families left behind, we say sorry. To the mothers and the fathers, the brothers and the sisters, for the breaking up of families and communities, we say sorry. And for the indignity and degradation thus inflicted on a proud people and a proud culture, we say sorry.
The Prime Minister's words were welcomed by Australia's Catholic bishops, who called the action a historic and prophetic moment in the life of the nation. The church leaders issued their own apology a decade ago, just 2 years after Pope John Paul met with Aboriginal communities in Alice Springs to reaffirm their culture and their human dignity. In a statement, the bishops stressed that this national moment of reconciliation must be followed by practical efforts to improve the living conditions of Aboriginal people today. To find out more about the background to these events, my colleague Charles Collins spoke with the head of the Australian Bishops' Conference, Archbishop Philip Wilson of Adelaide.
As a matter of social policy, in the early part of the 20th century, it was decided by some of the state governments to take children away from their families and to put them into institutions to care for them. It was a social policy that applied not only to the Indigenous people, but to other members of our community as well. However, the effect on the lives of the children of Indigenous families was especially disastrous and led to great pain and suffering. And a major report about this matter was issued 10 years ago, and one of the elements that was part of that was it was recommended in the report that the government would make an apology to the people for the terrible events that occurred in that process. So today, the Prime Minister and the Leader of the Opposition, our government leaders in our National Parliament, have made those statements of apology. In the light of that report 10 years ago, the bishops made a statement, the Catholic bishops made a statement, where they said that that they sought forgiveness from the victims of the policy that broke up Indigenous families and forgiveness for any part the Church may have played in causing them harm and suffering.
The Church has already issued its apology. What was the reaction to the Aboriginal leaders when that apology was made?
I think that 10 years ago, the reaction of the Aboriginal leaders was that they were pleased that the Church did that. But I think that the Aboriginal leaders and communities have also focusing on the present struggles and difficulties that they have, even in the light of the things that have happened in the past. So their greater concern is about the commitment that we've made now to care for them in all of the different situations in which they find themselves in our Australian community. And I think that that concern then is true today. And that's why it was important the Prime Minister said that today we remember that we ask for forgiveness and we say that we're sorry, but we also commit ourselves again to caring for these people. Because some of the conditions of the Indigenous people in Australia are really awful. They have a very high infant mortality rate. Their life expectation is much less than people of the European communities. They have major problems of health and social problems in all the communities in which they live, but especially in the communities in which they live in the countryside and in the desert and so on. So we all have a lot to do, and the church should be very strongly committed to that work.
You talk about the church being strongly committed to this work. Can you give us some specific examples of what kind of outreach the church is making to the Aboriginal community?
Certainly. The Aboriginal community finds itself in very different circumstances because Aboriginal people can be found in every part of the country. So some of them live in an urban setting in the middle of our big cities, and some of them live an almost prehistoric lifestyle in the desert. There are some small communities then that live the ancient way that they've always lived. So a lot of the responses the church has made are made by the local churches, by the diocese, so that there are centres all over the country that respond to the needs of Aborigines. So in Adelaide, for instance, we have a centre which is a focus point where we gather Aborigines together and try to respond to the needs that they have living in the midst of our city here. The Diocese of Darwin, which is one of our biggest dioceses, is largely a diocese that is covered by rural areas and desert. And the Diocese of Darwin has had a long history of running programs and centres caring for Aboriginal people, largely administered over a long period of time by the Missionaries of the Sacred Heart. But they've been joined over the last 20 years by other religious orders, so that there's a community of Mother Teresa's Missionaries of Charity who live in the desert helping with some of these communities and so on. So they're those kinds of initiatives that have been taken by dioceses and by religious orders that are very significant in the way that they try to help them with the social problems, the medical problems, and the educational issues that are part of their community experience now.
Now, you mentioned, of course, the apology today by the government. It's more what happens now. What would you hope to see the government do after this?
Well, I thought that today the Prime Minister made a very good commitment in saying that, that we have to renew our efforts and the government has to renew its efforts to try and deal with this. And I think that the really strong point that he made today was that he's establishing a national commission in which he's inviting participation by all the members of all the political parties in Australia, so that he issued the invitation today publicly that the leader of the opposition would join with him as the co-chairs of this organisation. And I think that that's a great initiative. This is a really huge problem for us to confront, and it will take a tremendous commitment on the part of the whole community. But I think that today has been a really strong emotional day for many people, and the strength of that emotion and the experience would strengthen their commitment to really want to do the best that we can to help these people, and to do it in such a way that we engage with them, not that we develop programs and we come and say, this is what we're going to do for you, but rather that we advance towards these communities and engage in dialogue so that along with them we can formulate what the program should be and how the aid and help should be given to them.
Thanks there to Adelaide Archbishop Philip Wilson, President of the Australian Catholic Bishops' Conference. United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon this week urged all countries to join forces with the private sector, with civil groups and individuals around the world to take action and sustain what he called the unprecedented momentum to fight global warming. At the start of a two-day UN General Assembly debate on a proposed new global warming treaty, the UN leader noted 2007 was the year when climate change rose to the top of the global agenda. 2008, he said, must be the year of concerted action to draw up a new blueprint to cut global warming gases. At the last UN Climate Change Conference in Bali in December, delegates from nearly 190 nations agreed to adopt such a blueprint before the end of next year.
Because the destiny of our world, either we live together and flourish, or in actual fact we're going to damage all the ecosystems. And if ecosystems are damaged, they're damaged for us too. So you can't have life to the full on a sick and damaged planet.
Former missionary father Sean McDonough is a well-known author and expert on climate change. He campaigns tirelessly to encourage church leaders to put greater emphasis on these ecological concerns. I sat down with him to discuss these latest developments and find out why he believes that climate change has finally made it to the top of the political agenda.
Well, I suppose there's a confluence of factors. In 1986, the British government commissioned a report from an economist, Sir Nicholas Stern, and that focused, yes, that this climate change could be the worst economic catastrophe to hit the world in the next number of years, or not, two decades. So very often, very much, economics is at the heart of the modern world. Not something I particularly like, but that's where it's at. Then last year, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, what's called the IPCC, they published their fourth assessment report, which 90% sure, which means 100% sure, that actually climate change is already happening, that it could be very significant, and that the window of opportunity to do something about it, in other words, to keep the level, the increase in temperature below 2 degrees Celsius, is 15 to 20 years. So there's an extraordinary urgency about the issue right now.
This is suddenly what's making an impact on people, isn't it? The fact that we were talking a few hundred years away, now we're talking just one generation away, if that.
That's right, from the scientific and from the political perspective. I wouldn't be sure, though, that it has transferred into the economic perspective. And why do I say that? You can read the newspapers and you'll see something, for example, on news items and on reflections. But if you go over to the financial pages, you will still see that the economics that's been pushed is an economics that actually externalises things to people and to the environment. The neoliberal economic agenda is still very much in place. And as long as that is in place, then, of course, this thing is going to get much worse, because the only way out to develop at the moment is by becoming dependent on fossil fuel. And the more countries, like, for example, China and India, that are becoming more and more dependent on fossil fuel, are going to make the situation worse. So we kind of really now are in a difficult position. We're talking about it, we're convinced about it politically, but economically we're going in the wrong direction. And I think that's a huge change. I saw that very much in Bali. There was no effort to challenge the economic paradigm. The underlying assumption was we can solve climate change within the reality of a market forces economy. The reality for me personally is we can't.
Bali was very disappointing, wasn't it, the conference that went
very,
on
very
there.
Disappointing for a number of reasons. I mean, if you take seriously the IPCC report, then you should be seeing a drop by 20 to 40% in greenhouse gas emissions for what's called the OECD countries by the year 2020. That's absolutely necessary, and yet no one took that up. The European Union were pushing it, but the United States delegation and Canada almost vetoed it up till the last night. And then, of course, the newly developed countries, they're not willing to jump, because they basically say, historically, your affluence is based on a carbon economy for the last 150 years. Why should we jump now unless you jump before us? So we have 2 years now before Copenhagen. And that was the great sadness about Bali, that we weren't beginning to put in place a new regime which would go much beyond Kyoto. And people are not aware really how much that will be. Kyoto was only five. We were to reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 5 to 7% below 1990 levels. Now what we're looking is 20 to 40%. In other words, you're almost halving your carbon in your economy. So unless you're actually producing energy in a way that's not carbon dependent, you're going one way with your talk, but another way with your action. And that, to me, is the real challenge at the moment.
As you say, European governments are pledging to try and take this very seriously, to meet these targets. Mm. Do you think it's a realistic proposal or not?
Well, there were difficulties about it. For example, one dimension of it was we were to include, for example, 20% increase in biofuels. Now, you have to think seriously, think through those sort of policy decisions. Where would these biofuels be coming from? Many of them would be coming from Southeast Asia, where people are burning forests, tropical forests, destroying all the biodiversity, putting all this carbon into the air, and then monocropping palm oil plantations. If you did an energy audit on it, you'd probably find that actually there's a net gain in CO2 emissions. So the European Union and countries within the European Union have to think seriously about the implications of this. The other side of it, of course, is from the agenda for the Global Millennium Goals. The problem at the moment is if your lands are being used for food or to buy energy crops. So you could have a appalling situation that the lands of the third world are going to be used to grow energy crops for the first world. So I think that's an ethical issue that's going to arise. Should you be burning food for energy at this time? And I don't think you should.
Alongside this, there are still those who refuse to admit that this really is a very serious problem, that perhaps there's nothing wrong with global warming. What's your answer to them now?
Well, my answer at the scientific level, there are still a number of people who think smoking is good for you. You know, if you have a problem and you're bringing a cigarette to your mouth every couple of seconds, it's good for your nerves. It settles you down. You know, there is no evidence in the world. All the evidence is pointing in the other direction. So I do say to people, would you bring on someone from Philip Morris to give a kind of a balanced view of tobacco? And the answer is you wouldn't. And I think that the same should be true of climate change. And any situation I'm involved with, I almost refuse to actually talk about the other side. And of course, all you have to do is look at the ExxonMobil, look at their website. They are still paying groups in the United States to come out with documents that are not peer-reviewed. And these documents, until very recently, were seized by the Bush administration to bolster their position that they were sceptic about climate change. Now they're supposed to have been converted, but in reality they have not been, because you saw what happened the week after Bali. California wanted to bring in legislation that emissions from cars would increase. For example, the mileage of cars would increase to 35 miles to the gallon, and the EPA, the group that should be protecting the environment and protecting the quality of air, and actually got the nod from a very conservative Supreme Court to do it earlier last year, are now willing to take these people to court. I mean, it makes no sense whatever, because almost every other jurisdiction, even in China, Chinese motor cars at the moment, they at the moment do at least 35 miles to the gallon. So, I mean, it's just obviously the Bush administration protecting its own very, very narrow base, which is petrochemical industry and possibly the auto industry in the United States.
We're looking ahead to elections, of course, in the US. Are you hopeful that these issues will be high on the agenda of the next government?
Well, I'm not really, because I just saw, and I reported there in one of my articles, that until about a month ago, the sort of talking heads had asked people something like 3,000 questions. And out of those 3,000 questions, only 24 related to climate change. Now, having said that, on the Democratic side, either Senator Obama or Senator Clinton, both of them are coming out with something beyond the Kyoto Protocol. On the Republican side, the only man who has come out with anything, actually, he's co-sponsored the bill in Congress there 2 years ago, is Senator John McCain. So one would hope, yes. The other thing, of course, and it was very clear in Bali, there were a lot of groups from the United States, particularly from states. There are 7 states in the West, there are 12 states in the East, that are actually voluntarily taking up the kind of commitments that's in the Kyoto Agreement, for very good reasons, because the California realises, the governor there realises that if global warming takes place, then the snows on the Sierra Madres will not be able to supply Southern California with water. And if you don't have water coming from another source in Southern California, you won't be able to live there. So it's enlightened self-interest more than an altruistic approach from the said governor.
You rightly say this is a moral issue, it's an ethical issue, and yet the church has been slow, in your view, hasn't it,
to
take it up?
Well, you see, The church is for the life of the world. That's John's gospel. I've come for, or John 10:10, I've come that they may have life and have it to the full. Now, if it's the most serious issue facing human beings, and then also facing habitats in which human beings have lived since the last ice age, because these habitats will no longer be available for humankind. For example, the habitat of the Delta area in Bangladesh. 35 million people live there, and if there's a rise of just over a metre in sea levels around that place, that will be uninhabitable into the long-term future. So, yeah, and it will cause deaths for literally tens, if not hundreds of millions of people. So obviously it is a serious moral issue. And obviously if it's a serious moral issue, it's a serious theological issue, because we're talking, I mean, at one level we talk about the world, but the world, in the view of religious people, is God's creation. So I do think we need to do, from the church's perspective, to develop a really robust theology of creation. And basically saying the stewardship model, that's not at all sufficient. Because first of all, it's too homocentric. The reality is we say we steward for the world. In actual fact, the world looks after us. You and I are breathing oxygen from which is created by our beautiful world. You and I have eaten our breakfast. So we are totally dependent on God's creation to live. And I think we're going to have to begin, yes, there is a dimension for caring for creation and stewardship, but we need to go way beyond that. And one of the ways we need to go beyond that is to give value to other elements of God's creation. I mean, one of the issues of climate change is it will probably wipe out a million species. So that ties in with the other major ecological issue of our time, which is the destruction of biodiversity. Now, I'd like to think that we can begin to see in our theology that these, every one of these creatures, every species has real value in the eyes of God. And therefore we develop that biocentric approach. And we have it in the Hebrew scriptures, the whole saga of Noah, not just taking his family, but taking two of each creatures. So there, right from the beginning, is a concern for God's creation. Then, of course, we have to have a real concern for the fact that the poor who have done little to cause it are the ones who are actually going to suffer most. And that's an extraordinary tragedy from the point, like Africa, will probably, grain production could be down in Africa by 50% because it depends mainly on rain-fed agriculture there. So there are a whole series. I mean, I would talk about solidarity, that the late Pope John Paul talked about solidarity with the poor, but not just with the poor, with other creatures as well, because the destiny of our world, either we live together and flourish, or in actual fact we're going to damage all the ecosystems, and if ecosystems are damaged, they're damaged for us too. So you can't have life to the full on a sick and damaged planet. Now, the church has wonderful resources in its own tradition, the whole notion of common good, the whole notion of natural law, the destroying processes of nature. Now, we need to develop these to underpin a very robust theology and also ethical framework. Because ultimately, unless people see it from an ethical perspective, then I don't think they're going to change their attitudes and change their behaviour. And as we're talking this in Lent, here is really an occasion where people can begin to say, I've got to change my lifestyle, not because, well, I'm going to do something for Lent, but if I continue to live this way, then many people on earth will not be able to live like this. And also we're going to make life on earth more difficult for every succeeding generation of humankind and other creatures. So the ethical framework and the ascetic framework are actually built into each other. And Christian and particularly the Catholic tradition has wonderful things to say about that. But we have been so slow. We've put it in a kind of the last paragraph of documents rather than right at the middle of it.
And yet we've noticed increasingly the number of churches that are taking up this issue, particularly during Lent. For example, your own agency, Trochera, back in Ireland, CAFOD, I've noticed the Tear Fund have also been calling for this kind of action, really focusing at this time of year on the ways in which we can change our lives, but not just for Lent, as you say.
Well, the interesting thing about these development agencies, they are now beginning to see that climate change is having a massive impact on the kinds of people that they have been dealing with for the last 40 years. Until now, they felt that development issues, we will stick with those and not sort of confuse ourselves by bringing in this ecological or climate. But now they're saying, for example, I went through the Philippines there before Christmas for 4 weeks before the Bali conference. Every place I went, farmers were saying, the southern monsoons seem to be gone. So that means a whole harvest of food for people who are subsistence farmers. So it means a lot of people are going to be hungry. And, I mean, the big thing for Southeast Asia is, and will be the fastest thing, is the melting of the ice on the Himalayas, because that supplies the water for the great six great rivers of Asia, the Indus in Pakistan, the Ganges, Brahmaputra in India and Bangladesh, the Mekong, Southeast Asia, and then the two Chinese rivers, the Guangzhou, we call it the Yangtze, and that's 3 billion people. And the scientists are projecting by 2030, 80% of the mass of the ice and glaciers on the Himalayas might be gone. That would be just frightening. Where would all these people go? Who would take in? You'd have an enormous amount of climate refugees. So these are very serious issues, and areas like, or groups like Caritas, like CAFOD and TROCRA are beginning to see this and beginning to move it into centre stage, not just on the sort of the wings of the stage where it has been until now. Now they're saying the environmental issue and the development issue are two sides of the same coin.
You're talking about developing this theology of ecology. You'd like to see it taught in seminaries, for example, wouldn't you? What other practical suggestions do you have to really make this issue a very urgent one for the church?
Oh, I would like to see it taught everywhere where Christian doctrine is taught. Because one of the difficulties with us in the whole area of environment, we haven't got a coherent discourse about it. At one level we say, we're earthlings. And next breath we say, well, we're for another world. Now, we have got to get our discourse that we're not making these kind of talking out of both sides of our mouth. As far as I'm concerned, humankind are earthlings. We can't live anywhere else. We need air, we need water, we need food. Now, that doesn't mean in our belief that we have not a very robust belief in the world that is to come. But the world, if you take Matthew 25, the world that is to come is dependent on how we live in this world. He's not giving us any great insight. He's saying, basically saying to you, the God you serve and the God who has loved you in this world will also be there to serve in the future world. We know the model is the resurrection of Christ, but that's all we know. We don't know the physics of it. We don't know the biology of it. But we do know the challenge of being Christian is in the Our Father, your kingdom come, thy will be done on earth. Now, done on earth means that we live in a world, a mutually enhancing relationship between humankind and the rest of creation for the well-being of everyone, but also for the well-being of the human poor.
What is your message to church leaders right now, today? What would you most like to see them doing?
I'd love to see them taking this very seriously. And one way of doing that would be, for example, in the Australian church and the Philippine church at the moment, they have decided to take what's called the time of creation every year from the first Sunday of September to the Feast of St. Francis. Each year, it's either 4 or 5 Sundays. So you would take a theme each year, like for each Sunday, like, for example, climate change, like the destruction of species, like, for example, the pollution of the oceans, like, for example, fresh water, and that you would knit into it prayers, ceremonies, readings from the scripture, that it would help to connect people's agenda of working for a safe environment, working for a fruitful environment, and also their service of God and their understanding that these two things are the same. And we as a group, as a Christian people who believe in incarnation, that the divine became part of creation, shouldn't have any major problem with that. I mean, that should become second nature to us. If God became part of the fabric of creation, why shouldn't we be actually thrilled to help people to see that their work for the poor, their work for protecting creation are essentially at the heart of their Christian faith. And I believe we've got to move from the periphery right into the ecology at the heart of Christian faith.
And my thanks there to Columban Father Sean McDonough, author and expert on climate change. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English Programme. You're listening to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.